maintain poetry activities. So eventually Stus became a dissident, part of a small but forceful movement for human rights. According to literature critic Yevgeny Stasinevich, Stus he considers that Stus comes next to Taras Shevchenko. He finishes the story Shevchenko started. They have the same ethical prescriptions, norms, and the image of a poet as a people mediator. Nevertheless, poetry of Stus, because Shevchenko was poet of Romanticism era, and he has this pathos and idea and like everything that you know about him. And Stus was, if not postmodern, then postmodern, but not postmodern era. Postmodern in Soviet Union era, his poetry does not consist agitation or something anti-Soviet, anti-regime statements, or even he has no certain political agenda. It's a poetry of a European tradition based on human values, and like this great narrative, let's say this word. Of being human, how to be human in different conditions, how to feel, how to live, etc. And of course, he was a poet of Ukrainian, of European tradition, because he was well educated and formed by Western literature. He translated Goethe, Rilke, Paul Celan, Kipling, Giuseppe Ungaretti, Federico Garcia Lorca, Guy de Maupassant, Arthur Rimbaud, René Char, and many others. So he knew all this poetry, he felt it. Of course, he loved Beethoven a lot, and he listened to him while he was not repressed, and he didn't get to the prison. One of his cellmates revises that, "I see an intelligent person of European culture with a Rilke's book in his arms." That is why his poetry, in the contrary to Shevchenko, is very complicated. It's not mass poetry, and he even did it in purpose, avoiding being like this mass poetry that was on the time in Ukrainian popular poets, with enormous attention to words, their sounds, and meanings. Recently, there was a concert in Art Museum based on Svyatoslav Lunyov music, which he wrote on verses of Ukrainian poets, and one of them were Stus poems. And this composer, Svyatoslav Lunyov, I'm a friend of a pianist who performed it, and I heard their talk, and Lunyov explained that you need to pay attention to words themselves, not seeing them, not like try to make sound which does not consist in the words. So you need to just, everything in poetry that need to be there is actually in how words sound. So you shouldn't put much effort to read poetry. And this concerns especially Stus, because his words, they have, you see the energy that palindrome feels, and we will see other ways to read his poetry, and it like, it bumps you, I don't know. It pushes you the way it's written. Quoting Slavistan literary critic George Yuri Shevelyov, he was born in Kharkiv, and after Second World War he worked in Harvard University and Columbia University. I will quote it. Political programs is not something that was in the poetry of Vasil Stus. The point is to find yourself in a world of spies, secret agents, snitches. Finding yourself is finding a Ukrainian person. Personally, I am happy to see a commonality with Rilke only in the fact that both poets seek an image of human feelings and state it in their becoming and not in their completion. I will draw a parallel from fine art. Delacroix, followed by the epigons of Romanticism, roamed the world looking for unusual and often exotic themes. In contrast to them, for example, Claude Monet, we can find dozens of paintings that reproduce the same portal of the Rouen Cathedral, or going even further, to intensive painting the same haystack. Someone said about Brahms that he wrote one symphony all his life, formerly four of them. In a certain sense, Stus writes his own symphony in most of his poems. But Brahms, of course, was lucky not to live in USSR without being repressed, without his works being destroyed. So he got this this chance to do his work. And overall, poets are those that change the world view of people. They reflect time and become a conscious and a symbol. And a true poet, he expresses what others feel. Like a great poet, Stus had a low instinct for self-preservation. That's an important thing, and I think what defines a poet, because poet cannot build a good career, or then he's not a poet, because he always should be against everything. It's a dramatic role. It's a role of like drama. It's a role of actually becoming an icon. You can revise Rimbaud and Baudelaire and every great poet. So now I will talk a bit about biography to illustrate this low level of self-preservation instinct. He was born on January 6, 1938, in a peasant family in Vinnytsia region. But 1 year after, his parents moved to Donetsk because to avoid collectivization, because at the time it was very, very harsh. Ukrainian historian Yaroslav Gritsak wrote that in Ukraine, traditional culture, which preserved in villages, saved this traditional Western Christianity, like Vertep. It's kind of a peasant theater based on biblical story. And these practices, they emerged from all the people that came from villages to cities during the Soviet period urbanization. And since most educated people were killed in the 30s, who lived in the city, these people from villages, new generation with something like core in it, they came and they very fast like gained the level of education, the level of knowledge, and continued somehow this their predecessors. He worked as teacher in Korlivka school, and he felt the catastrophe of Russification at the time because Donbas region was highly Russificated, and he wrote even a letter to a poet who was popular at the time, Malyshko, about the dramatic situation that Ukrainian language is disappearing. Then he had military service, and what's important, most people start writing verses, poems in teenagership, and it's okay, it's normally, but it passes then, or not passes, sometimes it's even
almost
a problem.
It's almost Valentine.
Yeah. But he starts to write poems during military service. Then he gets back and he works as a journalist. He entered a doctoral program at the Shevchenko Institute of Literature. At the same time, he published some of his selected verses in some magazines. It was the first and last publication of his works ever in Ukraine, in Ukrainian language. He married Valentina Popeliuk, sometimes you may see her here, and his son Dmytro was born in 1966. On September 4th, 1965, during the premiere of Sergei Parajanov, and Sergei Parajanov is Russified name, the real name of Sergei Parajanov is Sarkis Parajanian, because he was Armenian, raised in Georgia, so he was not Sergei at all. On the premiere of his film Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors, probably not all Ukrainians know this movie, but probably not only Ukrainians know about this movie. It was premiered in Ukraine, but a year before it was premiered in the West, and it gained success. And after 1 year, it got premiered in the country it was shooted. It like Soviet reality. A few people, Ivan Dzhuba and Vyacheslav Chernobyl, future dissidents, they wanted to use this opportunity of presentation of this film to tell about repressions about Ukrainian intelligentsia that started like 1 year, just recently started. So they had a conspiracy, let's say. They agreed that they will go on the stage and tell like, repression started, let's protest, let's do something. They did it. Stus wasn't aware of this episode. He didn't know that it was was planned, and they told about this. Of course, KGB agents that were in each second chair, they reacted, tried to make a sound. Some organizers of the event switch on the air ray, I don't know, siren, yeah, siren, to shut it down. But Vasil Stus was one of them who raised as a protest against the repression. Of course, there was another, like KGB agent, who like wrote down everyone who stand up, and it was the beginning of his dramatic way, because before it was everything okay. He was very well educated, he was on his doctorate program, huge career and good life was ahead, but he wasn't able to bear this kind of injustice. He was the person who was who couldn't stand injustice overall, and he was 27, the age when like all this club 27 people, all these musicians, you know, they died this age, and it was the level when you are boiled, when you want to like influence, when you are on the peak. And of course he did it, and actually he chose the road to actually where he finished. As a result, this very at the end of September, he lost his job. He was fired. He was fired from institute. He was fired from his doctorate. He wasn't able to finish his work, and he got to work on a building site, fireman, engineer, continuing his intensive work on poetry. He submitted a couple of books for publishing, but they got rejected because it was not like pro USSR, etc. And the main point that he was in the list of the people that couldn't publish books in Soviet Union. In 1970, his book, one of his book, was published in London, and that caused, of course, problems for Stus, because it was like a crime to have your book published abroad. So a few years later, in 1972, he was arrested for anti-Soviet agitation and propaganda. He was sentenced to 5 years in concentration camp and 3 years of exile in Magadan Oblast. What's interesting, that first term he get as a poet, because this a book wrote 2019, I think, by Kipiani, a researcher of Ukrainian Samizdat and a journalist. And here you can see the all the protocols of KGB documents considering Stus' case, because in Ukraine archives are opened, in Russian Federation they are not. That's why a lot of documents, they are still not available to understand what happened, and most important, how he died. And is this documents I wrote the I've read analysis, like literary critics analyzed for KGB his verses, and there was taste like, these are harmful, these are decadent, they're not optimistic enough, and this is like okay, it's like it's okay. Most of them, it's ridiculous, but anyway, they kind of was from the low side, but overall it was very ridiculous. So now a bit about generation of 60s. There is a term 60 years, or 60-tnikyy in Ukrainian. It's a generation, term itself is very complicated, because you cannot define and you cannot properly tell what is the what does it mean and who you can include to it. But what's important in their worldview was that it was a time of Khrushchev Tsao, or Vidliga, when Stalin died and his personality cult was denounced, and people start believe that now, like, it can be normal, it can be promised future may become. And sure, most of them wanted what that can be called like socialism with a human face. They were not anti-Soviet, they just want to make it like a better place to live, because of course they were like Soviet people with a certain level of views. Of course, they frustrated very soon, and despite writers of 60s having thin connections with the generation of executed and killed, repressed writers from 20s, 30s, they were their successors by spirit, and they read their books. As an example, you may use Nikola Zirov, who was very well-educated, so-called neoclassicism, neoclassicism author of 1920s, 1930s, and his verses, his poems were transferred by the Samizdat infrastructure. Overall, in 2014, there is a very interesting and very fruitful discussion about how to commemorate and how to treat Ukrainian culture heritage from Soviet Union period, because it's what's hard to separate ideology from real art, from architecture, from literature as well. But I think this discussion led to a pretty clear positions, and that's why we have a very good movement on preserving heritage that really that is really meaningful. So getting back to these 60s and to a group which TUS was part of, actually what happened were small groups of close friends who spent time together, who understood each other, they share their inspiration of the literature, they share their thoughts, they read poems to each other, as TUS in one verse named their "My Late Aets." It's from Homer. I cannot explain what Aets, but sounds Greek enough. They were trying to prevent repressions from 1930s, because of course they were aware, and if you probably know, after Stalin's death, there was a process of rehabilitation. Not all of them were rehabilitated, because like Mykola Khvilevy, one of the greatest poets, was rehabilitated only in the late 80s, but overall they knew about it, and they were they believed that they can avoid the new level of the repressions, that repression are in the past. But now they choose a way to oppose it legally, and as a human rights movement. And that's how they became dissidents. The circle was not anti-Soviet, as I told you, and not nationalist at all. It was even technically impossible. Most of them were from eastern part of Ukraine, and connections with people who were nationalist was very, very thin, because most of them were in Soviet concentration camps, by the way, almost ruined them because of their rioting, and helped the new generations of political prisoners, because before they frightened these criminal prisoners, because criminal prisoners were used as a tool for frightening these political prisoners, and they did riots, and so new generations of political prisoners were pretty safe because criminals afraid of them. Even about nationalism, I can remind you, if you don't know, Russian, they misuse every word. So if they put like nationalist, actually it's or fascist or Nazi or whatever, it just literally means enemy. And because even Sergei Parajanov was sentenced for Ukrainian nationalism. So Georgian Armenian guy was a nationalist, and also he had two reasons to get to prison. First is homosexuality, second is nationalism. The way it was. After first imprisonment, all of them, all these dissidents, they became anti-Soviet, because they understood everything, and they wanted to, of course, fight till the end, because they had nothing to lose. And human rights, of course, it was a crime for the Soviet Union. That's why from 60s to... these circles, they not only opposed, they didn't just perform this human rights movement, trying to save people, try to fight for these rights. They also created what is called, may be called, high culture. Literature, sometimes movies, literature critics, etc. Because in USSR only folk based on social realism, standard was allowed in occupied republics. It was not real folk music, which is now getting back, and you can hear a lot of interesting projects. Of course, they couldn't bear it, and they wanted to create something like really cultural and really like high. That's why from 1960s, Stus told that we should consider them ourselves aristocrats, not just folk people, but aristocrats. And he wrote a verse called Evolution of a Poet. I translated it via Google translation, but overall I think the meaning is still the same. A genius poet bifurcated on himself and fear. The semi-poet split into two, for a quarter poet and fear. The quarter poet split into two, in 1/8 and a fear. A poet's 1/8 split into two, on smell and fear. Now, as he passed down the street, above his head, white smoke hung, and the opposite ones are frightened, respectfully stepped on his way. Yeah, that's... So actually he wrote like he described perfectly how it happened, how it looked like to be a poet in a totalitarian regime. After first sentence he got back to Kiev. He had only 9 months before the second imprisonment. When he got to concentration camp for the first time, his son Dmitro was only 2, and when he got back he was almost 13. He was a teenager, and of course for him it was hard to set relationship with a father who he didn't know, plus teenagership. He blamed father for drop them, and it was like harsh even from this point of view. In Kiev, Stus revises, I learned that people close to Helsinki group were being repressed in the most fragrant manner. This is the least had been the case on the trials of Ovsienko, Horbal, Litvin, and they were soon to deal similarly with Chernobyl and Rozumny. I didn't want to that kind of Kiev. So what was the Helsinki group? At that time, USSR signed the Helsinki Human Rights Agreement, and became a part of this agreement, and they got to do something with human rights itself. But the problem was that this group that created this Ukrainian Helsinki group, they created to use this tool to save people within USSR, they were repressed. So first group that entered this Helsinki group was repressed. Second was repressed. And when Stus just wanted to enter it, he knew that he will be repressed. It was like obvious for all of them. And of course, he was not just a fighter, he was also pretty ironic. He had a sense of humor. And one of his friends asked, like, why did you do it? Don't you know you will be repressed? And he told, well, you know, an old lady asked me, I couldn't refuse. Of course, as Oksana Zabushka wrote in her late book, My Last Journey. My Longest Journey, about her father, because her father was repressed, and she told that it was very scary for all repressed people to get the second term, because for most of them, second term was the last one. People got died or broke under pressure. And so that happened to Stus. So if first sentence he got as a as a poet, second he got as a dissident. In prior to Olympic Games in Moscow in 1980, there were a lot of activities from regime to clear up country from elements that can be not look like pretty good. In Moscow it was harsh, like people with disabilities, with not homeless but like alcoholic, they just like removed totally from the streets. He was arrested and received a 10-year sentence for anti-Soviet activity, plus 5 years of exile. So if he would survive, he'd get out from this imprisonership in 1995. What's important and interesting in it that government put an advocate to protect him as Medvedchuk. Medvedchuk later became an influential, pretty influential Ukrainian politic, but it was also obvious that he was a KGB agent from Soviet period, because it was super obvious, plus there are documents, and he was kind of got to protect. Stus wanted to refuse to use this advocate, but he wasn't allowed to refuse. And Medvedchuk did nothing actually to protect him, and actually his as the result, Stus get the maximum term possible in this case. In October 2020, when this book probably was published, it was published in 2019. In 2020, Medvedchuk put to this author of this book trial about something that he was not right in this book, and actually there was a thing that literally told like the servant of Soviet regime, Medvedchuk, and Shistka, who understands Ukrainian, it's more precise, I don't know prison words in English, unfortunately, or not unfortunately, And Medvedchuk, there was a trial. It was very, very, very loud, of course. And eventually, Medvedchuk lost. He got to pay a fine, and also he promoted this book very well. And they got to make another thousand of books. And it was so. Thank you, Medvedchuk, at least for something. Of course, Medvedchuk, during the full-scale invasion, he tried to run away, but he got caught, and then he got exchanged to Ukrainian militaries, and now he is in Moscow, because he is like a KGB agent, and plus he is close to Putin. So there are a lot of people who visited the places of Vasil Stus's imprisonment, and one of them revises that afterwards he was in the camera when Vasil Stus died, and he told like I was close there just for experiment for 15 minutes, and he told like I couldn't like even I wanted to escape from them because it's super scary as hell. So Stus during the second imprisonment he was no right to write his own poems. He wrote almost 400, or we don't know how many verses he wrote, and all of them were destroyed. Only six managed to get out from prisons, from some things people transferred, but mostly people remembered his verses. Sometimes Armenian, Lithuanian, Jewish people, they revised his verses and then like published it. At the beginning of this movie, one of the prisoners who was in the same prison as Vasil Stus, he makes an excursion for the group and for the shooting group, and he finds that here I hided the Kipling's translation by Vasil Stus, and he like puts them out. I don't know, maybe it was a fake, but it looks like the thing, and. He got a lot of isolation. He got to isolation. It's kind of a karzer called for attempt to transfer verses from camp, and even translations were destroyed. Last another Rilke, a lot of Rilke in my talk. He translated Rilke for 1.5 years, and he told like if you don't let me write my own verses, then maybe I can translate Rilke. He worked on these translations. And they took them and destroyed. And probably this was the thing that put him to mental breakdown. He totally he passed. He was very sick. He had only 1/3 of his stomach because of the operation, and he was very. He had a lot of troubles with heart. So he was very very sick. And another few things that are important that. When his wife and the son managed to come to him, he screamed on his wife, like, why did you let to humiliate you? Because there are a process of inspection which was very humiliating, especially for women. And he told, like, why did you let them humiliate you? Because I'm here for avoid being humiliated at all. That was the thing, that mission that he saw. And another thing that people that was in was with him in this concentration camp told, that at the late period, the only condition for him to get back to stop being prisoner is to write promise stop opposing to the regime. It was pretty simple, but he refused it because he understood that it would be he should went to the age, and he did it, of course. There is also a very interesting myth about Nobel Prize, which he was almost get. But the problem is that Nobel Prize do not openly communicate what candidates do they have. But there are some committees that promote people for getting Nobel Prize. There was in fact a committee that wanted to promote Stus to Nobel Prize, and to tell the truth, Stus was the author that deserves a Nobel Prize. And the case was not like even artistic thing, but they wanted to save him because there was a situation with Nazi regime, with Hitler, when one of his opposers who was in jail, Karl von Ossetzky, was promoted to Nobel Prize, and they hoped that Hitler will set him free. Yeah, but Hitler was the guy that put him in the hospital, and he died in hospital. So anyway, he didn't save, but at least it was a chance. So to brotherhood, to Soviet regime, Nazi regime, they wanted, they thought that it will work the same, and they tried to save Stus. So probably it wouldn't have happened, but it could happen. And last thing is Rebori process, because by Soviet laws, prisoners that die in concentration camps, they get to bury at that very place when they died. But as Stus writing was one of his verses, and Palindrome did it, he wrote that we will die, but the movement will stay. And on November 19th, 1989, the remains of Basil Stus, Alexa Tichy, and Yuri Litvin, who also died in this concentration camp, were brought back to Kyiv and reburied in Baikove Cemetery. The ceremony attended is more than 30,000 people. They brought Ukrainian flags, which was impossible for Soviet regime, and they passed through the KGB building, and KGB agents, like, they watched, and they understood that it's the end, they cannot manage it, they cannot repress so much people. And there were also one black and red flag from Ternopil. And what's the most impressive thing is that in 1990s, the Supreme Court of the Soviet Union canceled Stus' verdict, and the case was closed due to the lack of evidence. That's a perfect end of this thing. And another comparison with Shevchenko, process of burying of Shevchenko was people wrote that it was kind of a burying of a king, because Shevchenko, you know, the level which Shevchenko had. And it was something like, which was similar to Vasil Stus as well, because it was something that he, it was almost like biblical story when he as a Christian martyr, he put his cross, he put it to the edge, to to the end, and then a lot of people he impressed, and it probably he was the one of the reasons why Soviet Union falls, because Ukraine was one of the first republic who escaped it. And also his last address was at Chernobyl street, and that's another symbolic thing, because a lot of historian Sergei Plakhy, Yaroslav Ryzhak, they consider that Chernobyl was one of the important things that led to escape Ukraine from Soviet Union because it was led by Soviets. That's all for biographical side. Thank you. Now we can have intermission. You can go to toilet. You can go to the bar. Cash is better for the bar. But if you have no cash, you may use a PIN. Let's see you in 10 minutes.
Sorry daarvoor, lieve luisteraar. Ze moesten even schakelen. Nou, dit was een heel verhaal over... was het die stoes? Ik moest even pauze. Ja. Zo. Die lichten zitten een beetje in de weg.
Zit daar vast.
Jij weet niet wat er allemaal uitgaat.
Heel kort op de zonnestroom.
Er gaat een beamer uit namelijk.
Ja, dat bedoel ik. Ja, dat zal niet de eerste keer zijn. Oh, wil jij een liedje zingen? Nee? Ah, jammer. Nou, dat was een leuk kindje die was een liedje aan het zingen. Nou wil ik eigenlijk even... shit. Even roken. Sorry, lieve luisteraar, geen drugs op de radio. Perfect moment om even te praten natuurlijk. Misschien zijn er nog buitenrokers die wat te vertellen hebben. Hallo.
Hoi.
We zijn live op Radio Potterboel.
Oh, wat leuk.
Ja, toch?
Je bent live?
Ja.
Oké. Okay. Gek.
Ik ben een beetje nieuwsgierig, want ik zag jouw foto's maken de andere kant op, zullen we maar zeggen.
Ja, ja. Altijd tegen de stroom in, ja. Natuurlijk. Altijd de onderkant zoeken en de tegenkant. En het contrast. En de mensen.
Vergeef mij de associatie, maar het zag er echt uit alsof je alle gezichten wilde fotograferen of zo.
Nou, er zitten heel veel mensen in het publiek. Het lijkt me leuk voor de mensen die het georganiseerd hebben dat ik ze kan opsturen. Mm-hmm. Te kijken wie er waren, hoeveel mensen er waren.
Ja.
Of ze geïnteresseerde gezichten hadden. Dat zullen we later op de foto terugzien.
Ja.
Ik ben fotograaf, dus ik doe dit. Ik vind het interessant. Ik vroeg net aan een van de Oekraïners of de dichter ook aanwezig was.
Ja,
en dan is het zo pijnlijk.
1985.
Zij zeiden 58, maar het blijft 85. En ik dacht dat hij aanwezig zou zijn.
In gevangenschap in een concentratiekamp.
Ja, het is overleden. Een soort Nazim Hikmet-achtig verhaal.
Wat voor verhaal?
Nazim Hikmet.
Oh. Tell me all about it. Ik heb geen idee. Ik weet niks.
Een Turkse dichter.
Oh.
Zijn lot lijkt daar een beetje op. Vind ik. En ook zijn taal. Maar daar kom ik niet... Ik moet nog eens achter boeken aan. Ik heb nog geen vertalingen gelezen.
Ja.
Maar ik ben hier ook om steun te brengen. Om door er gewoon te zijn.
Nou, hartstikke goed. Ja.
Dat is het eigenlijk.
Ik ook.
Ja.
Maar doe je dat vaker dan? Gewoon ergens naar binnen lopen of zo. Of tussen...
qua fotograferen.
Ik heb het gevoel dat jij gewoon naar binnen loopt en gewoon een beetje foto's.
Nou, ik kom hier wel vaker in het Vrijpaleis, maar meestal om kunst te kijken. En ik ken Stefan, de bookie man.
Ja,
en
die woont,
die woont op de Herengracht achter mij.
Ja.
En ik zei...
Dat is 167, toch?
Oh, ja, maar zijn nummer weet ik niet uit mijn hoofd.
Oh.
Maar mijn eigen nummer
is wel belangrijk voor de luisteraar.
Ik moet zo nog naar huis. Dus.
Ah, ja, nee, maar onze lieve luisteraar die wil weten waar dan iedere dinsdag dat zich afspeelt natuurlijk.
Ja, nou,
want
ja.
Hij doet elke dinsdag, toch?
Ja, maar hij heeft ook bij op de Herengracht sessies met gedichten voorlezen, schilderen.
Ja.
Hij heeft
elke
een
week.
Hele pro-Oekraïne muur in de Treeftsteeg. Prachtig. Dus ik kom hem iedereen hier een beetje te steunen.
Goed.
En ik neem altijd mijn camera mee.
Mooi. Ik vond het wel diepe geschiedenis, hoor.
Nou ja, maar
we hebben het
over onderdrukking. En Oekraïne in de 30e jaren.
Ja,
natuurlijk, toen werden ze,
nou ja, het is
toen werden ze helemaal aan hun lot overgelaten.
Ja.
Het is,
ja, het is ook best relevant om daarover te weten. Want hallo. Ze staan aan de deur te kloppen.
Ja, aan de deur te kloppen.
Nou ja.
Ze trappen
een understatement. Understatement. Ja. Okay.
Maar er zijn van die plekken op de wereld waar altijd alles, en dat is Oekraïne, en dat is de Balkan, en dat is natuurlijk Israël sinds 1947, waar het nooit...
Als mensen nou gewoon stopten met geloven in sprookjes... Hè?
Als ze nou zouden stoppen met geloven in geloven...
En ja,
dan zouden we ook. Maar goed,
dat is al te ambitieus. Laten we beginnen met de sprookjes.
Ja. Maar
die zijn makkelijker te
prikken. Ja, maar dit zijn landen die heel veel met sprookjes hebben. Hè, met veldslagen uit 1200 tegen de Bulgaren.
Ja, sprookjes zijn ook een soort vluchtheuvel.
Het zijn sprookjeslanden ook.
Ja, het zijn vluchtheuvels.
En dat hebben die mensen ook nog steeds.
Ja.
Dus dat maakt het allemaal nog moeilijker om op te lossen.
Mm-hmm. Nou, ja, nee, ik weet niet. Die sprookjes die kunnen toch ook vluchtheuvels zijn voor de vrije gedachten?
Ja, dit zijn oorlogssprookjes.
Ja, oké, okay, ja, natuurlijk. Ja, dat begrijp ik wel.
Het is allemaal met zwaard en bloed.
Maar ik vind paarden en bisons. Echte sprookjes vind ik veel mooier.
Ja, maar ik heb wel sprookjes voor mijn dochters voorgelezen, waarbij ik op 3/4 dacht, hier moet ik iets gaan aanpassen. Want dit is te gruwelijk. Die sprookjes van Grimm, die zijn heel naar.
Ja, maar ja, weet je, ik wil zo belangrijk dat
kinderen dus wel, ik
ook,
ken een sprookje,
ook lezen over...
Is een sprookje, dan zitten er een paar ooievaars op hun nest en een jongen gooit er een steen naar.
Ja.
En het einde van het verhaal is dat de ooievaars hem een dood zusje komen brengen. Die heb ik toen, heb ik dat een beetje aangepast.
Maar
om
kinderen
dochters...
moeten er ook leren dat shit happens.
Ja, maar met mij als vader leren ze wel dat het leven hard is. Hebben ze dan hebben ze geen sprookjes voor nodig.
Ja, oké. Okay.
Hoe vind jij het?
Ja, ik vind het razend interessant. Ik val van de ene verrassing in de andere.
Weet jij of er gedichten van hem al zijn vertaald in het Engels of het Nederlands?
Ja, volgens mij wel. Er staat daar zo'n heel boek over hem.
In welke taal?
In het Engels. Wacht even hoor. Nou, die buitenkant zag er wel een beetje buitenlands uit. Cyrillische toestanden, weet je wel.
Mag ik zo even een portretje van je schieten? Met je gear. Het licht is hier echt perfect, hè?
Alleen in actie.
Alleen in actie?
Ja, je mag geen foto maken van mij in mijn eentje.
Maar het is altijd wel een vlieg.
Ergens ik ga nog even muur. Met iemand anders praten.
Ja, lijkt me heel goed plan. Ik ben helemaal totaal uitgeluld.
Kun je jezelf nog voorstellen?
Nee hoor, helemaal niet.
Nou, goed.
Een geïnteresseerde.
Ja, meestal is het wel zo trouwens, als ik zo vrij mag zijn, is dat als mensen zeggen dat ze niks meer te vertellen hebben, dan komt er nog iets heel interessants.
Oh, nou, dat zullen we dan afwachten. Dat gaan we afwachten.
Ja.
Ga even naar Stefan, want die heeft dit half georganiseerd.
Ja, dat weet ik, maar die heb ik al gesproken.
Kijk, en die heeft nu zijn vriendin, komt langs.
Ja.
Gaan ze kussen. Kijk maar, gaan ze kussen.
Ja. Dit is prachtige radio hoor, je staat live verslag te geven.
Ja.
Zeg maar wat er allemaal gebeurt.
Veel voorbijgangers. Oh, het meisje gaat weer weg.
Ja, sommigen gaan weg. Ja, die houden zeker niet van muziek of zo.
Die heeft net het woord vuurtje geleerd. Want zij komt dan uit Amerika.
Oh, je
en toen
kent
zei
haar.
Ik tegen haar. Nee, ik ken haar niet. Oh. En toen zei ik tegen haar: wat is dat eigenlijk een mooi woord? Vuurtje. Vuurtje, daar komt ie. Vuurtje. Vuurtje. Ik doe alleen benzine.
Ja, eigen vuur.
Waar ben jij aan verslaafd? Nou, dat ja.
Tabak.
Ik doe alleen benzine.
Ik ben gestopt met roken. Nee, ja. Ik ga even met iemand
praten. Ga even naar Stefan. Je moet naar Stefan.
Nee, die heb ik al gesproken.
Hallo. Stefan is gek.
Ja, Stefan is hartstikke gek. Die heb ik al keer gesproken van de week. Volkomen klaar mee. Wie ben jij dan?
Ik ben Rogier.
Oh, jij was iets aan het doen, ook met een trap en zo. Dus,
met een ladder, even een lampje wegdraaien.
Oh ja. Jij bent van de techniek hier in het gebouw? Of,
ja.
Ja, ja. Oké. Okay. Dus jij woont hier een beetje? Zo.
Nou, wonen was maar zo'n feest. Ja. Maar nee, ik heb een werkplaats beneden.
Ja, oké.
Okay. Dat houdt een beetje draaiende.
Ja. Wat doe je dan in die werkplaats?
Meultjes timmeren en kunstwerk sculpturen maken.
Oh, leuk. Ja.
Ja.
Ja, hartstikke goed.
Ja, en de boel hier overeind houden.
Ja, dat is ook belangrijk.
Ja, dat is een mooie klus. Dat,
ja, het staat al een tijdje toch, dit?
Ja, het bestaat eigenlijk al sinds 1980.
Ja.
Maar wij hebben het nu sinds 2018. Dat is ook alweer even.
Ja.
Maar
hebben we 5 jaar gevierd vorig jaar eigenlijk?
Nee, we hadden het moeten vieren, maar we hebben het nog niet gedaan.
Oh, dus nou, dat wordt wel een keer tijd dan.
Ja, dan moeten we maar eens een keer een feestje geven.
Het verschil tussen die jaartallen is eigenlijk al te groot.
Nou, ik vind het dat namelijk zo'n heel jaar vind ik eigenlijk al arbitrair.
Oh, wacht, nee, het is meer. Ik zit er helemaal naast, joh. Het is al 7, joh.
Mm-hmm.
Hè? We hebben nog steeds niet de 5 gevierd en het is al 7.
Nee, maar dan vieren we toch gewoon 10-jarige bestaan volgend jaar.
Het gemiddelde, ergens half, op 7,5.
Ja, precies.
Vier tegelijkertijd 5 en 10.
Ja.
Ja, wat een onzin.
Geschiedenis een beetje in de war brengen.
Ja. Dan hebben die winnaars ook iets om tegen te vechten.
Precies.
Ja, toch?
Ja, nee.
Zo, we hebben de geschiedenis van de winnaars.
Mm-hmm.
Daar ben ik aan. Maar die Stoes, kende jij die al, die man? Of,
nee. Ik had hem even gegoogeld toen dit aangekondigd werd.
Dat is
wel, heel veel meer dan Wikipedia wist ik niet. Nee, okay. Ik heb 2 gedichten opgevonden.
Nou, weet je meer als ik.
Ja, dat, maar het is...
Ik probeer altijd zo onvoorbereid mogelijk te beginnen.
Ja, en ben je wijzer gaan worden?
Ja, zeker weten. Hoor. Ik val van de ene verbazing in de andere. Joh. Ja. Wat een verhaal, man.
Ja.
Ja, toch?
Ja, absoluut. Ja.
Het is wel heel erg geschiedenis, weet je wel. Oké.
Mm-hmm.
Maar goed, het is wel best een relevant verhaal natuurlijk.
Ja.
Het is nog niet klaar met die...
Het
is nog niet klaar met die idioten allemaal.
Een held in Oekraïne.
Ja.
Officieel ook.
Ja.
Ik
ben blij dat we dit dan per ongeluk uitzenden.
Ja, nee, heel goed. Dat je...
Maar wat gebeurt er verder hier eigenlijk allemaal in het
verleden? Ja, meestal...
Want ik heb een beetje moeite om achter het programma te komen.
Ja, dat is... er staat wel steeds vaker iets op de website. Schrijverlijst.nl
daar heb ik dus gekeken. Niks te vinden hoor.
Deze is ook pas vorige week aangekondigd bij ons. Ik hoop dat we weer naar binnen moeten. Maar,
de doorlooptijd is meer dan een week met die website of zo.
Volg je Instagram?
Nee hoor.
Daar zijn we wel...
Verdamme man.
Daar zijn we wel...
Van die vieze woorden op patapoe. Gadverdamme.
Dat is onze medium voor de aankondiging.
Oh, lekker. dankjewel. Wat was je naam ook alweer?
Rogier.
Dankjewel. Gauw weer terugschakelen. Lieve luisteraar. Oh, ja, we zijn te laat. Story of my life. Het is alweer begonnen. sorry, we gaan even schakelen.
Previous part was dedicated to life and struggle of Vasily Stus and a bit of his poetry. And a part of Stus Fest was an event, or like I don't know how to call it, like a project that was called Soldier Stus, where Ukrainian soldiers read verses or poems of Vasily Stus. One of them was Maxim Krivtsov. Probably you, a lot of you know him, Dali. He was killed on January 7th. I remind you that Stus was born on January 6th. Maxim recorded reading this poem one day prior to his death. And I will switch on verses that he wrote. But before, I would like to invite his sister Anastasia. She is here, and she will give you a lot of bit information, more information about Max, about his life, and Stus in his life. Anastasia Krivtsova.
Thank you. So today we came here to honor Vasily Stus, but he is unfortunately not the only one, not the only poet in Ukraine who was fighting and struggling for something what was right and had to die for his basically values and for his wishes. So I want to have a little tribute for my brother Maxim, who was killed on 7 January this year. He was inspired by Vasily Stus. He liked his poems, and he was going to read, to record like 4 poems for this festival. Unfortunately, he was able only to make 3 of them because he didn't have time to do the last one. And I want, like now, people here in Netherlands and people all over the world and in Ukraine, of course, to remember him because, you know, Vasily Stus, he was not just a poet, he was a hero who used his word to stand up for truth and freedom, as our poets who are now at the war, who are on the front line, do as well. And of course, even though the times were tough, Vasily Stus never stopped fighting for what he believed, and my brother as well. And my brother, he had a book called Vyshit Bienitsi. Possibly you can order it via this QR code. It is available also in electronic version. So please, if you didn't read it yet, it is very good. And so as Maxim was inspired by Stus, he had a brave heart and a brilliant mind, as Vasily did. And Maxim's poems were full of passion and deep love for our country. He stood for what was right, just like Vasily Stus did. And let this event will be not just a tribute, but a reaffirmation of our commitment to the ideals that Vasily Stus and Maxim Krivtsov lived, wrote, and fought for. And may their courage inspire us, and their words guide us, and their memories unite us in the pursuit of a world where art triumphs over tyranny, and the truth prevails over the oppression. The cruel hands of fate may have silenced their voices, but the echoes of their words will forever resonate in our hearts of those who yearn to freedom and justice. Today, as we listen to Maxim's voice breathing life in the verses of Stus, let us remember that these words are not mere echoes of the past, but urgent calls of the present and guiding lights for our future. So please, I ask everybody to support, to remember poets who died, and to support those who are living now, because we have a lot of very talented people in the front line who are fighting right away at zero, and who are very talented and who are struggling every single day fighting our enemy. So please remember and listen to Maxim now, and listen to Stus, of course, and order a book. And like, let the force be with us. Let, I hope, for our close victory.
скажи, Модельяні був ідіот. А скажи, Модельяні був ідіот, допитувалась вона, коли я правними, як у піаніста, пальцями вигравав на засмаглих персах. Такий же ідіот, як і всі в цьому світі, повчав я, обіймаючи успокоєні вибухи її сидіць. Розумієш, старий, я часто думаю про незвичайність мистецтва. Це зайва розкіш. Так, мистецтво – то завжди надмір, відповідав, виціловуючи коліна. Але надмір лише рятує нас від убогості. Смертним полишається єдине, бодай маленький надмір у вірі, у звичках, у смаках, просто в примхах. Так, моя маленька, саме так. Ти, як завжди, говориш діло, повторював, клацаючи зубами від пристрасті. А коли в нас народиться доня, ми кластимемо її в узголів'я, тільки троянди, охриплим голосом проказувала вона. Так, в узголів'я і неодмінно троянди, не своїм голосом, я погоджувався покірно, яка докучлива муха, зіщіть і дзищіть, убий її, любчику. Василь Стус у цьому полі синьому, як льон. У цьому полі синьому, як льон, де тільки ти і ні душі навколо, уздрів і скляк блукало в тому полі, сто тіней в полі синьому, як льон. А в цілому полі синьому, як льон, судилося тобі самому бути, аби спізнати долі, як покути. У цьому полі синьому, як льон, сто чорних тіней довжаться, ростуть, і вже як ліс соснової малечі, устріч рушають вдатися до втечі. Стежину власну наче дріт згорнуть, ні вистояти, вистояти, ні стояти тільки тут, у цьому полі, що наче льон, і власної неволі спізнати тут, на рідній чужині. У цьому полі синьому, як льон, супроти тебе сто, тебе супроти, і кожен супротивник у скорботі, і кожен супротивник з заворон, не знаючи, вергатиме прокльон, твоєї самотою обгорілий, здичавлю в дух і не пізнає тіла у цьому полі синьому, як льон. Василь Стус напередодні свята. Напередодні свята, коли люди матнулися по крамницях, виносячи звідти шпроти, смажену рибу, шинку і горілку з перцем, якийсь дивак, обутий модні черевики. Такі тиждень тому були виконали в універмазі «Україна» 22.50 з навантаженням, дитячі штанці 18-го розміру. Облився чортівнею і підпалив себе. О, він горів, як порося, смажений примусом. Налетів на людей, що культурно собі стояли в черзі за цитринами. Порозбігалися усі як один, від нього так несло смаленим, носа було навернути ніяк. На щастя, узялося кілька міліціонерів, одразу вкинули його в машину і помчали в бік Лук'янівки. А чергами таки достоялись. А як же? Що то за святковий стіл без цитрин? Де вибух? Якого хера?
Що пішло?
And now I would like to commemorate all killed soldiers with a minute of silence. Thank you. Now is the last part. We will watch a chamber opera called Василь Стус поем, Василь Стус пасербай, or Василь Стус перехожий. You can scan QR code and get English translation of the poems. Please raise hands once again who is not speaking Ukrainian.